Welcome to the Strong Source Commodity Podcast. We are your hosts, Martijn Bron and Alexander Sterk.
Hello, everybody. Welcome, listeners, to yet another episode of the Strong Source Commodity Podcast.
And today, extremely happy that we have one of the guests that I have been always admiring. It's Dwight Anderson. He's the CEO and founder of Osprey Capital Management. And when we were thinking about doing the podcast, immediately Dwight was one of the persons that came up that I wanted to have in the podcast. But, you know, along the way, I thought, you know, is he ever going to do it? You know, it's such an impressive guy, one of the legends, certainly, you know, among the traders that I have met over the years in my career in trading grains and oil seeds and especially also cocoa. And so I was happy that at some stage I got to speak to one of his colleagues and I said, look, what do you think? Do you think that Dwight is going to be interested in the in participating in the podcast? And fortunately, he was. And I know Dwight from quite a long time in the early to mid 2000s. At the time, that was kind of a commodity bull run, commodity super cycle. And I just made the move from grains and oilseeds to trading cocoa. And we did a tour, a hedge fund tour in New York and Connecticut. And then I also visited the offices of Dwight. And, you know, being in Cargill, I thought that it would be hard to find someone who would know more than me. One of the first discussions with Dwight, it was completely insane how much he knew about cocoa. And I was very, very impressed. And it was not just a trader who traded that because of the latest narrative of the commodity, but I saw that Dwight was genuinely passionate about cocoa. And I find that quite surprising because it was a niche commodity, but that is what it was. It was genuine passion and deep knowledge and from certain origins where I simply didn't know much. And yeah, that I took away from Dwight. And then in preparation of this podcast, I found out a lot about Dwight that I didn't know. He's not only a hedge fund founder and trader, but also an investor. Later moved into venture capital and has done a huge amount and also worked with legends like Paul Tudor Jones. So one of the questions that we always have to our guests, who in the industry do you admire? Dwight is one of mine. So I was a bit nervous, I must say, for this podcast, if you're going to interview one of your heroes. And I also said to Alex, look, I prepared Alex for Dwight because you are so knowledgeable. And yeah, it's just great to have one of your heroes in the podcast. So yeah, that is how I got to know Dwight. Thanks a lot that you want to join. And also, especially for the audience, it's incredible that we have someone of your caliber with such a diverse commodity trading and investing profile in the podcast. So yeah, that's my intro.
Well, that's a hell of an intro, Martijn. I mean, I will just stop. I will just do kind of a mic drop and then just try to, how the hell did you end up in the world of commodities?
Well, what I'm worried after an intro like that is there's no way but to go down. Okay. And so familiarity breeds contempt. And I'm worried you guys will quickly discover that I have clay feet. So I appreciate those very kind words and I'll do my best to try to keep it interesting. In terms of how I got into commodities, I was a liberal arts major, history major undergraduate, and was not that introspective or forward thinking. It was my assumption that as a history major, my only path really was going to be to get another degree that actually would bear fruit for a career. But I was fortunate, having gone undergraduate to Princeton, that people gave the benefit of the doubt. And I had also done a contract program in the summers to help pay for college. And so had a programming background in addition to that. I took the LSAT, I applied to law schools, I got in, and I woke up in a panic in February of my senior year, because for the first time I actually thought about what that would mean. And I realized I didn't want to be a lawyer. And so I interviewed with every possible firm that was still coming to school to interview for jobs and got an incredibly weird range of job offers. And one of them was to be a programmer for a software company that dealt with automation for manufacturing companies and had a consulting division based in Chicago. And when I called to turn them down on the programming side, they said, hey, you know, the consulting division is growing leaps and bounds and we're short of people. And you seem like you have one of the more flexible backgrounds. Would you join? So to be dealing with different manufacturing companies, to actually try to, you know, keep jobs, raise the standard of living, improve productivity, do something tangible and beneficial, was something that resonated with me. And so I went and took that job, went into a training program with 18 industrial engineers, all of whom had been in 5-year work study programs, and by far the most ignorant, which is something I'm often, you know, in life. And ended up bouncing around the United States, dealing with different clients of the firm, and then took a job with a client running, you know, being a production manager for a paper and printing plant in upstate New York. And to be 23, 4, 5 in that role, there was no one within 20 years of my age in the company at that role. We had high unemployment in the town, we had high literacy, we had the highest Hispanic population in the county in the U.S., higher than Dayton, El Paso. It was very introspective time. You're forced. Okay, I would work, you know, 12 to 20 hours a day, 5 to 7 days a week to try and help. And the rest of the time I had imposter syndrome. I didn't want people to realize how little I knew and how young I was, and gave me time to actually, or forced me to think, what do I want to do in life? What am I good at? And I realized I could probably do consulting, but then I'd always live somewhere and then be on the road. I could probably do manufacturing, but I'd always be somewhere that had a cost advantage, which might not be the place I'd want to raise a family. And so what possibly be good at, okay, and enjoy. And so the idea of going to proprietary trading from my circle of friends and reading, you know, led me to thinking, how the heck do you transition from a printing plant in upstate New York to Wall Street? You got to go back to business school. You know, you have to whitewash yourself in that. And so went back and was fortunate that University of North Carolina offered me a fellowship. And from there to go to Wall Street, where the sales pitch is obviously is, I know manufacturing, I've seen many environments. And so commodities and basic industries. And so Jay Aaron made a leap of faith and gave me a summer job and also a full-time job there, as well as the equity division to work for Danny Ock. And then separately, JP Morgan did as well subsequent. But the name of the fellowship that I went to for UNC Chapel Hill was the Tiger Fellowship. Hmm. And it was given in honor of Julian Robertson, who, when I began, I didn't know whom that person was.
Yeah.
But I wrote him a thank you note. Okay. And he said, hey, if you're ever in New York, please stop by. And so I did, and ended up doing a project for Credit on how to change the tax status of Tiger Management because it was inefficiently set up, and got to know them. And then Julian reached out after I'd been at JP Morgan very briefly and wanted to do more in commodities. And thankfully, the Rolodex in his head was paper thin, and there was really only one name. And so out of lack of a better alternative, he made the offer to me to come with relatively no experience from JP Morgan to Tiger. And so long-winded answer, which is, again, a fault of mine. But that's sort of how the whole transition, my whole life has been one form of basic industries or another.
So basically, just like a lot of other people, you ended up in the world of commodities by coincidence a bit. And so Wall Street, right? So when I hear Wall Street, oh, I'm like, how is it working on Wall Street? As a guy from the Dutch side, we don't have Wall Street. We only know it from movies. How is working there?
It's competitive. No, it's a high-driven, high-motivated individuals. And so that aspect of demanding and generally a meritocracy, not always, in certain cultures, you know, I watched this occur for a period of time at Deutsche Bank, and like were aspects that strayed and erred from that. But that aspect of short in terms of patience for fools, okay? And high expectations and motivation. And again, it changed from cultures to another. Goldman Sachs was much more aggressive. And in terms of that, whereas JP Morgan was much more about the culture and the institution and the like. And so there are degrees on the continuum of that. But that aspect constantly of meritocracy, aggressive, motivated, is something that is consistent. Although people have different motivations. Some people do it, you know, out of pursuit of excellence or competition. Others who tend not to, in the end, always be the most successful, they'll do it purely for the drive for money.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What was your drive?
For me, it's an aspect of, I love the intellectual challenge, you know, whether it was, I played sports in college, but also with some friends, we won the intramural championship for bridge. You know, that aspect of counting cards and assessing if you're given enough data points, you're given a chance of proving, do you have alpha? Can you generate? And can you win and get a winning record? And so that aspect of a scorecard and winning and the objectivity of it. Was something, and the constant intellectual challenge is something that just, you know, I really enjoyed. And if you're successful, you're going to do fine.
Yeah.
And if not, I was going to go back to consulting.
And the thing that What I've been thinking about a lot is if you, for example, and we're talking about Wall Street here, Wall Street is more, when people think about Wall Street, they think more about stocks, so the stock market. And that's an interesting thing because that's constantly in the media. And that was also one of the reasons why we started the podcast, to actually show people more about the commodities industry. And I always felt that being a commodity trader is intellectually more interesting. Now, maybe that is not correct, but do you also see that trading commodity is intellectually more interesting than almost saying, well, the stock market, if you look at the S&P 500, is just buy and hold and you'll be fine. That is absolutely not the case with commodities.
So you always worry about the hubris, self-rationalization that you talk yourself into. The aspect of the difficulty of the net negative, not zero sum, of the commodity trading world. So if I buy a contract and you sell it to me and it goes up, I win, you lose. Okay.
Yeah.
And but it's actually not even that 50-50 because you have commissions. Okay. Mm. You have, your prime broker, you have everything such as that. And so let's just say gross numbers, and we've looked at it, is roughly 60-40, 60% probability of the net individual losing capital when adjusted for trading and transactional related costs. And so there is a pride, I will tell you, that there isn't a beta that I can just, lean back on and ride. Okay. I have to take money from someone somewhere else in the world, and I'm competing against everyone in the world for that. So yeah, there is an aspect of that pride, but it's also, there's an element that's a little bit different, which is harder for stocks. And there's an idiosyncratic judgment of people and human, their predilections, that can change path of stock so much. Mm-hmm. So is if you're the CEO and all of a sudden you decide you want scale and you do bad acquisition, I could be completely right about the fundamentals of your assets, your industry, and still get the stock wrong because of a person.
Okay? Yeah.
And so removing the human element in aggregate in the commodities is something like, therefore it's an objectivity analytical side that I like, but I respect the heck out of people like my former boss, Julian Robertson, who was amazing as a judge of people. And then those people who are stewards of capital. So I don't know about the intellectual challenge of it, but I will tell you that there is possibly a wrong pride of the difficulty of it.
Yeah. I'm very interested always in people who are well-known and respected, almost legendary in the industry, as I said in the intro. But also, look, Julian Robertson, Tiger Management, the Tiger Cubs. I've known about that, but can you tell us a bit more about him and what you experienced in that period that you worked there? Because also what is super interesting, as is from the 80s till the end, it was extremely successful. And again, doing much better in terms of returns than the S&P 500 over that period of time. But at the end, in 2000, it closed. Now, I don't know whether you were already gone or whether you have seen that kind of peak to trough. Can you tell us a bit what it was to work there and to work with him and with other talented people that later were called the Tiger Cubs?
So I left July 6, 1999, which is 9 months before Tiger closed. It was an amazing place to work because of the autonomy and just sort of responsibility that Julian gave you. So his central tenet was sort of research, fundamental research, and being correct on that. And if it is, he was willing to take tremendous volatility just on the comfort and conviction that the economics in the end for an industry or for a company would win out, and the valuation mattered over time. And to be exposed to people and under the tutelage and mentorship more directly of people like Steve Mandel, okay, in terms of loan buying, of how to take a look at a company and a management team and assess it, was integral and key to sort of my development. Because Julian was not so much a direct mentor, okay, and a lot of times his was mentorship through tough love. In terms of, because I think I set a record for the firm of being the dumbest person to ever met like 36 months in a row.
Okay.
But he gave you, if you needed to get research or a consultant or anything like that, and the time or travel, the resources and the time to do it, whatever. And so it was more through support and trust in your process rather than through direct. Whereas, the association with Steve Mandel actually sat down and worked through and goes, here's how I look at a company. Here's how I assess a management. Here's the questions. And you had to present on the Friday lunches every now and then, you had a rotation, an idea too. And so you had all the other people there, Andreas Halvorsen, Rob Pitts, people like such as that, Rob Citrone, who are amazing minds who would assess your idea and the merits and the process questions. And so it was that running the gauntlet, of that, that was as much the learning process. And so Julian was exceptional in his memory and some sort of pattern recognition and a unable to articulate way of judging people in terms of that, that was superior. And that is something that I aspire to, but have not been able to do myself in terms of that level. Like you take a look at the success of all the other people who are there and it's relatively unparalleled. And that aspect is something that is one of the greatest. Now, at the same point, as Julian was one of the most competitive people who I ever met, he struggled on that aspect of keeping those people there because he believed in much more of sort of a single manager system. And if you have someone like Steve Mandel, at a certain point, he wants to try and see if he can do it on his own. That aspect, plus minus, like if there had been a way that he could have been as competitive and good and demanding as he was and kept the people in some way within the umbrella, it would have been a massive, entity to this day and lived on beyond him. But, that's the flip side of the coin.
And that I found super interesting because I didn't know. Then you moved to Paul Tudor Jones. And I find that very interesting because that's another one of my heroes and who I met. The funny thing is, I think it's funny. I don't think he was as genuinely passionate about Coco as you were. But when I gave a presentation at Tudor about Coco, it was insane how quickly he picked it up. And you could see that he was interested, but he wasn't a specialist. But the types of questions he raised and the conclusions he drew, kind of blew me away. When I was, supposed to be the specialist, I had an intense debate with him about the cocoa market. So extremely impressive. Now, can you tell us about you moving from Tiger to Paul Tudor Jones, what it was working with him, and then actually starting up your own firm within his firm? I find that very, very interesting how that all went.
So Julian took a chance on me at an age and responsibility that no one sane should have. Okay. And I owed him a debt of gratitude and loyalty to this day for it. I'd been there only a couple months when the person who was a senior person in that area, Bob Bishop, left. And Julian came to me and said, I'll give you a year to do this. And if you, succeed, you get another year. And if you don't, then I wish you best. Yeah. And so we had that annual deal each year. And so I'd been approached relatively early in my time at Tiger to leave and go other places and then be given, a book or portfolio or capital. But I felt I owed him a certain amount of return back for the chance and risk that he had taken on me. I worked at Tiger 4 years, 9 months, which for senior investment professionals put me in the top 10% of duration for people who worked there. And Tiger and Julian's aspirations had evolved to a size and a different business model than I enjoyed, where he kept only wanting to be in bigger and bigger stocks, but more and more capital to it, and had started hiring senior experienced investment professionals on contracts, as opposed to people earlier in their careers who were still trying to move up and motivate different. So there was a cultural change in the employees brought in, and there was a size. And so in basic industries in the 90s, relatively quickly, my universe of markets to invest in collapsed to 20, some small number. And so I no longer felt that I could be as relevant. And in 1 year in 98, I think my P&L was $1.8 billion. And we lost 2x that in 2 days in dollar yen. And so I'd had, through good luck, about as good a year as you could possibly have in basic industries. And in that calendar year, it was irrelevant. Okay. And so that aspect of collapsing relevance, some new change in the firm felt I'd been there long enough to pay him back for the risk he had taken. I decided I wanted to see if I could do it on my own. I knew that I was had shown that I could be a decent analyst within a firm, but actually running a firm, taking risks solo. But at the same point, given that I was adding responsibilities and incremental, I wanted to outsource as much as possible that wasn't critical to that. And so I knew that I wanted to partner with a firm who would handle back office and the capital so I could focus. So I was fortunate in that there were three different firms who had expressed interest, Steve Cohen, Lewis Bacon, and then Paul Tudor Jones.
Wow.
And all three put me through an interview process and then made offers. And all three are to this day some of the best investors or traders who I've ever met and good people as well. But Paul's offer, and while it was the lowest in dollars and the lowest in payout, but the one that if we were successful, was also the aspect of the one that would be the highest returning if we were successful over many years. And then the other part is Paul is an exceptional human being. He is generous. I've met people randomly in the world who he helped out that, you know, there's no reason or benefit ever could be to him. And he did it, you know, quietly and anonymously. He's generous to his fault. And the people who had been in his firm, who had both succeeded and failed, always said, Paul is good to the spirit of a contract, not just the letter. And so you don't know how your first year or two are going to do. And so to be with someone, you know, such an aspect who you know is patient and is good and understands it. So we chose Tudor Investment Corp to be our seed capital effectively as a way to sort of focus on the markets and what we can invest outsource and, you know, for the nature of the relationship and a bet on our longer term success. And I also, to be honest, thought that Paul, given his background in commodities, would be more of a teacher and a mentor. But I discovered relatively quickly in the months of being there that our styles were so different, okay, in terms of duration and that while he was supportive, okay, he wouldn't be instructive. Like I talked to him about us taking delivery in nickel and somewhere else. And he's like, you know, sounds good. Best of luck. Okay. And he meant it, but like he would never take delivery. Okay. So, you know, just they were wonderful partners, but again, more from an organization and capital and spirit perspective than an instructive.
Really impressive. Because what I always found so fascinating about the hedge funds when they do commodities, you know, you guys do many commodities, you look at many industries, you look at currencies, everything. How do you, you know, when you say, you know, do you take a delivery on nick or not, or you have discussion about cocoa, how do you make sure you got all that knowledge in-house about these commodities, right? And then on high pressure, making these decisions?
So what you do, and it's a benefit of a good margin business like hedge fund, private equity, you know, related, is what matters most is, are you right and are you profitable and obviously preserving capital? And so you, if you have critical mass in terms of size and assets, you have the resources to invest in having a great and ideally better people around you working on industry specialists, and then also the greatest in the world, if available, who are there, whose forte is research and supported numbers and knowledge, but maybe not risk-taking. Because it's definitely one of the things I found over the years, is there are people who will know and be more accurate, potentially, in base metals than myself, okay? But they don't have the emotional comfort with the risk and the path and the chance of loss. Like there's a gentleman who's been in Macquarie Bank named Jim Lennon, who's as good as he gets in base metals. Jim wants to be an analyst. He doesn't want the pain of just going against you and the responsibility. And so it's finding those people out there that you can rely on and also reinvesting because, you know, people retire and move on or lose their focus and work ethic. And so the way that we're able to do it is by the constant sort of reinvestment and finding the best human capital and resources out there that will support myself and my team.
Well, there's so many questions now going through my head that I want to, but one, this one I'm going to ask you first is about how do you sleep then with all that risk, you know, and because you want to take that risk, right? That's what you do. So how do you deal with that risk year in, year out?
I definitely think it has aged me. Okay. I don't always sleep. Okay. It's usually a sign there's a problem with the position. It's too big if you have problems sleeping. So, you know, one of the critical aspects is making sure you're sized appropriately for your duration. Okay? Yeah. You know, so you can be there in the time period to show that you are right or decide you're wrong without a dramatic loss. And so, you know, it's an aspect of position size and management. And there's a very dangerous and precious line between confidence and insecurity.
Yeah.
You know, so the people who are, you know, been in this business who have had phenomenal returns, okay, but also phenomenal failures are those who know they're right. There's a gentleman who's passed away named T. Boone Pickens, okay, who I met, who is big in the oil and gas world. And I, you know, we were involved in trading oil and we had a detailed balance sheet of all the oils and the supply and where's it going and demand. And T. Boone came in and I quickly worked out that when he talked about leverage, he only calculated leverage where he owed margin, okay? And certain firms had given him where. So he was like 8 times levered, but only thought himself as 4 times levered because the other 4 times didn't require a variation margin, okay?
Yeah.
And so we talked about oil and gas, and he goes, I was like, what's your analysis? What's your balance? He's like, all, ain't a lot of it. And it took a minute for me to understand that all is his accent, meaning oil, okay? And his balance sheet was, there ain't a lot of it, okay? And so T. Boone had years where he made a couple 100%, and he also had years where he lost 100%. And so that confidence, and I've met a number of these people who have the blessing, okay, and the curse of knowing they're right. And they sleep perfectly every evening because they know they're right. Again, they'll make more and they'll lose a lot more. for myself, it's a constant balance of you have to have sometimes an inordinate self-confidence that the work or the math and everything you've done gives you, you know, the confidence that you believe you're correct. But I live in constant insecurity and self-doubt. Am I wrong? Am I wrong? Like, what is the other person? Is there something I've missed? And you want to talk and meet to as many people as possible. And so, yeah, it's not a happy, generally, place in life. Remember that? You know, I can generally sleep because of position, sizing, and time. It's not always. But it's that aspect of you do have to have, again, and it's that fine line of self-confidence without excessive, you know, to believe that you've done the work and you have that and that edge in the alpha, to know that your position is most likely correct. But gosh, there's plenty of moments of paranoia and insecurity where you question it.
So that never stops. Also, when you get your experience, it doesn't matter. You know, you still have it. I think it also keeps you sharp, right? The moment when you think I'm 100% sure, you're going to fail, right? I mean, it's never 100% sure.
Yes. I think it's a critical element what Dwight says. Huh? Because I first thought when you said that, I first thought that you were going to say, it's a fine line between confidence and arrogance or confidence and complacency. But what you actually wanted to say is, which I think is really good, that you say, well, it almost sounds like a paradox that you need to have both confidence, absolutely, but still be insecure to be constantly asking yourself, what if I'm wrong? But it sounds difficult, I think, for people who are not professional traders, because also in the online world, what you see a lot is people who actually are convinced of the almost what I would call mathematical truth. And the whole point is, and I give that example very often, I have had very often felt that the S&D that I had was correct, 100% correct, that I had a truth in my hand, on my screen. Yeah, I just knew that given the work we had done and the track record that we had, it was the right S&D. Yet, the market could be trading something completely different for months.
Yeah.
Right? So I find it very, very strong that you said that. But also, and that was also one of the reasons why we wanted to start this podcast, to hear it from someone like you. And that you should, even someone a caliber like you doesn't have the ego to say, well, I'm right, and go big or go home. You're constantly thinking about, okay, what if I'm wrong? And if I'm wrong, can I get out? And can I do something about that position? And that's also something that I have seen often with Paul Tudor Jones. He says his first risk management. That's the first thing he thinks about. Not about necessarily how much money he can make, but how much he can lose. Yeah, and that enables you to stay in for the long term. Now, that is a nice bridge, I think, to 2008. You first went solo with your partner after Tudor Jones. Then you started Osprey. And then in 2008, the great financial crisis hit. And that was a challenging period for everyone. It was, you know, an unprecedented environment. And could you share with us how you experienced that period and how you managed the fund in that period that felt like the world was coming to an end?
So I'm going to try and take you back a little bit for the path.
Yeah.
And where and how we got there. I began trading capital for just Tudor in the fall of 99. And it was always as a separate portion. And then Osprey was separate and independent, you know, within that umbrella as of, we took external capital February 1 of 2000 and then managed that all the way through. And in years 4 and 5, we got the size and we were returning capital. Yeah. And in terms of the size of the team and the markets, and then we sat down in 05 and said, all right, what do we want to do? Do we want to stay the same size and just become more internal capital? Or do we want to take advantage of a relative first mover advantage and basic into season commodities and create, you know, just something that is a sort of a full, you know, range of products and for a firm for people. So private equity, you know, long only sort of real return enhancement fund to funds. And so we decided, you know, due to youth, age, opportunity, hubris, whatever you want, okay, to actually see if we could build something unique and standalone in the basic industry space. And so as opposed to keeping the main fund in Osprey sort of closed and limited size and returning, we decided we would grow that, add in the incremental products. And so we went, you know, $1.25 billion to a $4.5 billion main fund and added in all the other products as well, which took us, you know, just shy of $10 billion in total. for the assets there. And one of the mistakes I made was growing too big, too fast in terms of just the number of people you're brought in. It takes 2 years for people to really adapt to a culture and a process and working together. And almost everyone who comes into a firm, the first 6 months is negative value because the time spent in bringing them up to, no matter how good or how old, you have to figure out how they're in relative style. You have negative return, neutral, and then positive. And it really takes 2 years for that integration to occur, or you need to figure out that it isn't going to work and fit. And then you have to move the next person. And so the number of people brought on, the size we had brought on, and we were also one of the biggest, if not the biggest, in basic industries. And so we had material positions, not just in commodities, but in equities, high yield, fixed income. We would own 5 to 20% of companies, 50% of their debt. And we had always, one of the reasons why I decided to leave Tiger and go on my own is the people at Lone Pine had asked me to join and go with them and do the basic industry element there. When I asked about doing commodities, they wanted to keep it a long short only equity. And there was going to be a sort of checkout fund of if the investor wanted to do commodities too separate. I wanted to make it more of a integral and focus. And so in the end, decided to do it on my own as opposed to joining them. So conjoined within Osprey was, all of those different elements. And we managed the long short and the net within that. And so in the end, the problem that we had in 2008, in addition to the sort of size, scale, and speed of growth that we had managed and were managing, was the leverage, the size, and hence the illiquidity of the fund and the positions we were running. And we had this problem in 06, but again in 08, there in the end is a fundamental tie between the commodities and the related equities, but that correlation can break for 2 quarters at a time massively. And it takes a month for it to be a problem, let alone 2 quarters. And so we had material net longs in the high yield fixed income and equity space, and we were massively short in the commodity space. And what most people don't realize is the equities and related imploded first. Crude oil only peaked the third week of July in 08, and the equity had already started going. And I'd only had one losing year in my career at that point where we had lost, net about 4% in 06. And going back to the origin of when we started with Tudor is, they'd asked for if I ever had a certain amount of a drawdown because we wanted long duration capital, except from, what would cause the lockups to break, because the majority of our capital is 2 and 3 year lockups to fit our duration. And we had left in just, it was the right thing, even though we didn't have to, given the sales we had, the aspect of lockups would break if we were ever down 30%. And so, so 20%, because I'd never had, that sort of a drawdown. And we're down 1 or 2% at the end of June of 08. We're down, 8 or 9% at the end of July of 08. And the first week of August of 08, I'm now down over 15%. I've never been down 15% of my life. Okay. And I know my lockups break at 20. Okay.
Yeah.
And I had seen what happens if people know that you have to liquidate positions.
Yeah.
Investment banks don't give you, extend risk to you. Cautious people stay away from your positions. Predatory people go for it. And I'd seen massive loss of capital for investors. And I actually didn't know that we could gate before then. I didn't know it was when there was, and when we talked about it, I'd never talked about investors, and I thought it was wrong to impose gates, which in hindsight was a bad business decision, but I thought it was the right thing to do and trying to do the right thing for investors. And I had no clue what the path was going to be. We had, many billions of dollars of commodity shorts, but I needed to be there to get there. And so we thought the more prudent thing, the right thing for investors was to liquidate the risk, and so in those 3 weeks of August of 08, we liquidated every liquid position inside the firm and across the board. We said, we are going to present a closed book to everyone. And it wasn't the most liquid time to do it. Yeah, a bond we trading at, 96, and they go, I'm going to sell 20% of a company's worth of these bonds. And they go, 84, and you hit it. And so it was the right call. But it was painful, and it was hard, and it was stressful, and trying to get it done in time before anyone knew. And so it taught me the risk of leverage and illiquidity and the cost of that and the path risk. And so that's what went on with that fund there. And we decided subsequent, we would never cross asset classes to try to manage net risk, in a concentrated illiquid portfolio was one of the main lessons. But it was painful. It was, psychologically, emotionally, I mean, it was the first time I'd let people go because of, in the end, the errors of my judgment, and the cost to investors and friends who had entrusted you with their capital. And so we presented them with a down roughly 35%, but liquidated, return. And I take a look at Citadel that went down 56, 58, 60%, but gated, okay, and just, earned their way back. And we were told at the time, no one would ever trust someone who gated. But the act is, if you return the capital and then ask people to give it back to you, you're forcing an active decision. If you gate and you earn it back, well, then, you have, that aspect that you'd never force that active decision back. So we did the right thing, we thought, in principle, for the investors. But from a business perspective and hindsight, I don't know if that was the correct decision.
Very interesting. How did you deal with that privately? Because you had a family, right? And you come home every day. How did you deal with that? Did they notice anything or?
Well, my 06 is when my son was born. 08 is when my daughter was born. And this is 08. So no, they didn't notice a thing.
Okay.
But I have an unhealthy aspect generally to drawdowns and problems, and that I withdraw, from friends and people and try, and it's not the right way to do it. But, I try not to burden other people with the aspects, and, you should be better turning to other people for resources and help and all that. But it's not something that I manage in a healthy aspect. And so you try not to bother the people, you try and carry on and just deal with it with your coworkers and yourself internally as best as possible. So it's not something that I've done well.
But you recovered very quickly, huh? With the fund.
Yeah, but I still bear the scars today, so I'm not sure I've recovered fully. Okay. But the answer is that, as you created such extreme situation as of March of 09, and the stimulus response was also so extreme that you had a phenomenal, landscape and opportunity set in which to reinvest from there. And so so the crisis itself created the opportunity subsequent.
Yeah.
It's just really mind-blowing, the experience that you already have in your career so far. How was it also to be, I started my own company. How was it from, working for somebody and then running your own shop? How was that for you?
So you get into the aspect of carefree and happy versus some aspect of pride and satisfaction is two very different. And I will tell you that underneath the umbrella of Tiger, where in the end it was Julian's firm and his name responsibility to the investors and to the employees, I could be much more carefree. Okay. And I was also single. Is when you go off on your own and I look across to the two of you and say, entrust me with your capital or come work for me and entrust me with your livelihood. I haven't been carefree since the summer of 1999. Okay. Because I have asked people to trust me and then take that responsibility. And it's always there because I have jobs and savings that I'm responsible for. And so it is something that we take very seriously, and I do, and it weighs on me. And so that I hadn't really appreciated it until I took on that mantle. And when I went to Jason Capello and Jason Mraz and said, I'm going to be starting this on my own. Are you willing to take this risk and try this? You had a point in your career and life where you'll join me to try and do this, okay, to start this. And so to sit across from people and ask them to do that, you take the success, and then you also take the responsibility when in a year like 08, you have a bad year. So the aspect that your investors, if they were there day one, which many weren't, still had a very good return from inception to liquidation, just under a 10% net compound return. A lot of people didn't join there from the beginning, okay? And people took a loss. And so it is something that is, as I said, at times creates a satisfaction, okay? But in general, it just creates a real sense of responsibility.
I can relate a bit to that. And then what you say, sleepless nights, these kind of things, it's not just in your case, it's you work with the savings of people where they worked hard for, but also, of course, the people internally that you supply for them a job, provide for them a job, they have a family perhaps and costs that they have. So, I mean, I think that can weigh quite a lot on people as well. But if you look at people that you, especially when you started your business, we have listeners here that also want to join this industry of commodities, either in hedge funds or in the world of Cargills or the Nestle's of this world. What are you seeking for in your case, in your business for people?
We're talking people that we're looking to hire?
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
So, one of the aspects that you always start with integrity.
Yes.
Is this person, an honest person, in all aspects of how they act with people back and forth. And I've had exceptional people I worked with in terms of their competence in the markets, but who didn't treat people well. And so as much as they could potentially generate a profit in the market, they wouldn't be a fit within the character of the firm that you want to deal with. One of the things that we prize is almost all the people that we meet here have given the filter it takes already get to, because we tend to hire people out of another firm, out of a UBS or a Morgan Stanley or a Goldman Sachs. the IQ is there, okay, but the aspect of a work ethic, you know, is, you know, there's a tremendous amount that, that can really be done, you know, in terms of, you know, the willingness to really, you know, put those hours in. One of the toughest things to really figure out and one of the greatest differentiators over time is judgment. You know, you can be tremendously smart, have good work ethic, but your judgment of people or an opportunity, a money-making opportunity, that sense is the subjectivity that you can't grade or test for, unfortunately. Okay, it would make my life a lot easier. And so, you know, that those quality aspects, you know, one of the things that is something that we've seen, you know, as a commonality is people who compete, whether it's debate, bridge, you know, sports, you know, that aspect of people evince a willingness and a desire to compete. Yeah? And at whatever levels, as much as the aspect in that, you know, you take a look at some of the Ivy League sports, they're never going to win against Alabama. Okay. Or, you know, but they've also learned to compete and lose, okay? And still carry on and continue. Okay. In that, you know, a lot of the people in certain aspects of the Ivy League have never lost and they don't deal with failure well. Okay. And so that aspect of competing and trying in the process and improving and accepting failure along the way and improving from it and still keeping going are criteria that we see has a correlative pattern to success in our industry.
Yeah. Great. When you said integrity, and that I find super interesting, it's, I always think about, well, Warren Buffett, he says, yeah, I look for integrity, intelligence, and energy. Now, I can really relate to that. Now, you said that there are people who can make a profit, but who don't treat people well. Now, if you think about a hedge fund managing money, where would you, or how, what kind of behavior would you then see? Would that then be internally in the firm, or how would that be being not working with integrity? So how, what kind of stuff?
Well,
what kind
two of different aspects of that.
Yeah.
One is interpersonal and one is in integrity. And there can be people who have horrible interpersonal skills who might work in the right hedge fund setting. Like if you're an individual pod and some multi-manager where you just, you know, live by what you eat and kill within that group, then you could be, I'm talking our culture, because our culture is independent on exchanging information with companies, with other people, other analysts, and that dialogue and management teams and giving as well as getting in order to keep a long-term relationship, to have a dialogue and build the network and information flow. So that aspect is critical for our culture to succeed. Long-duration investing and in companies as well as commodities and being able to develop that information flow and make it evaluated for the counterparty. And so one of the things that's critical for us that we're surprised that most people don't do well is speaking to people who worked with them before. We do a lot of character references because there are phenomenally high-functioning sociopaths, okay, who will do great in an interview. Okay? You know, it's hard for them to hide that if they work with people for 2-3 years. And so we want to go back and speak to, you know, their manager, Susan, whatever, and say, Susan, how are they to work? And their coworker, Bob, you know, whatever. Okay. And so, you know, that aspect of we really try and understand what they were like to work with, because we give those people dramatic more weight than the superficial judgment we get in an interview. In terms of character and integrity, it's harder to evaluate that. Like, you know, obviously we do, you know, all the background checks and whatever else and speak to the people. Some of that develops over time. Like, do you take responsibility for a problem? Do you own it in terms of that? And something small. There was a person who had was an incredibly successful analyst in the Credit Suisse Investment Banking Analyst Program who came to interview with us, who'd been had a 4.0 GPA at Duke and had it on their resume and did great in the interviews. And when we did the due diligence, we noticed on their transcript in the last semester at Duke, there was an asterisk and didn't actually say graduated. And when we looked, the person didn't graduate. They didn't finish a course. Okay? And so even though the interviews have gone great, they did download courses, is they didn't tell us. And if you told me my girlfriend broke up with me and I went into a tailspin and I just didn't finish, I didn't graduate, I get it. It's human. Yeah. Just be straightforward with me. Yeah. If you're not transparent, honest about that, then that's a non-starter. And so we wouldn't hire that. We didn't hire that person. And so that.
It's perfect. Because that's also, you want people, especially in trading, you want people to be straightforward that something is going wrong. And they don't try to hide it until it becomes too big.
And that's, if they don't also.
And that's also
they don't ownership responsibility. They don't learn from it.
And that, I think, something for you and that running the firm and owning the firm, you don't want to have a surprise and are basically a sleepless night about having a doubt about someone if he has a, he or she faces a problem. Do I know it? Is it escalated? Or
So when we tell everyone, we tell our managers, we tell counter members, we want bad news immediately.
Yeah.
Good news can wait. Like, you know, if there's something phenomenal that happens at 11 p.m., you can call me at 8 a.m. Okay. If there's bad news at 11 p.m., I want that. Okay. I want that call. Okay. Right away.
Yeah.
And, but isn't, how do you, for example, at the end of every, how do you start your day? So, you know, how is your day starting?
So 5 a.m. ish, you know, 5 to 5:25, you get up and you take a look at what's going on in the world in terms of markets. Is there, you know, news? Is there a price move you need to react to? What's occurred overnight? Okay. You assemble, you know, that. And so you don't tend to interact much with people too much other than electronically, you know, some sort of messages or emails, you know, sort of before 8. You tend not to have a breakfast or a meeting or a Zoom before 7:38. So the opening hours are all about just sort of, you know, coming up to speed on events, news, price move, actions, you know, some summary of the day before. And then as you roll forward from there, it's that interaction between 7:30 and 8 and 2:30 p.m. of what's going on in the markets and meetings that you have. And as people who run low leverage but concentrated risk and longer duration, it isn't that often that any, you know, 15-minute, 60-minute time period generally, you know, matters too much. So I can do a meeting with a copper analyst or with, you know, ADM or Bunge to go what's going on in oil seeds and crushing and really dig in and focus on that, where I don't have to worry about the individual price movements. Whereas most CTAs and volume macro are huge leverage, short duration, and you can't move away from the screens during that time. Because we're low leverage, concentration, longer duration, it allows me to blend. And then, you know, once you get to 2:30, you know, pretty much everything, and usually generally starting 1 p.m. on, things are, you know, calming down. You know, the information's been digested. There tends not to be something new. And that's when you then start moving to other meetings and times and handle and management in terms of that. And so, you know, when does the day end? Does it, you know, end at, you know, 6, or do you have a dinner? And that is depends on the individual day and location.
Yeah. Is it, if you look at, you know, yourself now and the years over time, are there things that you like now differently than when you were a bit, you know, when you started with your role? Is there a difference in what you, where you really get the enjoyment from? You know, I was always a deal hunter. I loved the vibe of the deals. What is that? Where do you get your spark from?
It's my belief that at a certain level in any job or role, or there takes a level of creativity. Mm. So most people don't think of accountants or lawyers that creative, but you take a look at the solutions of how can we create a solution, you know, that is legal and works, you know, for your client. And, you know, I could create an instrument that acts as debt when it comes to tax, but looks like equity when it comes to, you know, the credit. Okay. Holy cow. You know, you just created something that really benefits your clients and is unique. I mean, and so that process for me that it, you know, is you'll see a gap out there in the world in terms of the industry or something that it's going to be. And can you build a solution for it? Or can you take a position and actually to profit in terms of that? And then the constant learning or getting incremental data points. And is it a confirmatory data point or not? You know, does this, you know, change the path or the size or the probability of the position? And so the constant aspect of assessing data and learning and right and wrong and extrapolating. And then what does that mean for the future and the outlook? And there's definitely been time periods where we've more, you know, sort of like in tune, right? Like, you're like, holy cow, I get this. I get what's going on in the world. And they see the point of this. You actually have a vision. You can see the road going forward. And there's other time periods where I'm blindfolded, holding on to the leg of an elephant and trying to figure out what it is and talking to my coworker who's got the tail and is equally sort of, yeah. And so, you know, is there's highs and lows of your alpha at any one time and knowledge and sort of thing aspect. And, but that period of time when you go, okay, this is all fit together and I see how this is going to go and you're getting the confirmatory, that's a really, really nice feeling.
Yeah.
The aspects that I don't handle and manage as well, and it gets much more into sort of companies' investments, is like, is dealing with the needless friction that people will create at times. You know, like you have two coworkers or co-founders who decide not to get along. Okay.
Yeah.
Or they, you know, you've invested in a copper company, all of a sudden they decide to go pay a higher multiple for a gold company. Like, come on. Or we can fill in, you know, all sorts of other aspects. That frustration of some of the path, you know, along the way. And at other times, like, you don't understand why people don't see it. Like, you know, we own this company. It's trading for 100. It's look at the great things. The earnings are going up, but the cash flow. Why is it still trading at 100? Like, how can you not, you know, the frustration of like saying, hey, this should be 200 today. And, you know, that effort of waiting. And you don't understand why people don't see it as well is at times frustrating.
Yeah.
I don't know how much time you still have, right? If you need to finish, just let us know. But
would you mind if we took a 2-minute break?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. For you to check out the markets. And because I have some more questions, if you have time after having looked at the markets.
And that'll be fine. Just give me 2 minutes and then, you know.
That is not enough. So I found what you said very interesting about, and it was to a large extent, you know, doing the fundamental analysis and get the picture. Now, it made me think about, for example, the podcast that we had with Tom Kopczynski from Blenheim, who I also know as a fundamental trader, and Wim Koiker. And it also made me think about Anthony Ward, who you certainly know.
Yep.
Well-known, one of the most famous cocoa traders, cocoa coffee traders in the world. And the interesting thing is that Anthony Ward explained on Bloomberg when C Plus folded that was driven by algorithmic money overwhelming the market and he not being able to have an edge anymore as a fundamental trader. Now, and Tom Kopczynski said something similar. And I think probably with them, it was that they missed the technology boat. Now, you mentioned Cowen from 0.72 and you mentioned Citadel. Nowadays, the markets, not only in terms of execution, whereby 99% of all the trades are executed algorithmically, but the trading strategies to a large extent are also driven by algos. And firms who can invest huge amount of money in technology and also hire different types of traders, quants, people who can code, different than I was educated in you know in the late 90s in Cargill. And so my question is, how have you dealt with that change in market structure, if you will? And so participants, hedge funds moving from people who you could talk to, who you could visit, to driven by, you know, a huge amount of data sets analyzing and algorithmic strategies. How did you personally deal with it? And also the firm. So how is it that you are still successful as a firm and still have an edge in that changing environment?
One of the reasons why we've generally been able to manage through it is a difference in duration and sizing, and we adjusted from the size. We were amongst the biggest, if not the biggest, in base industry commodities through 08, and that had pluses and minuses, you know, in terms of things you could do in the market and can't then versus now. But the aspect in terms of what's happened in the evolution of the market is the bear market that occurred from May of 11 through May of 2020 put most discretionary traders out of business. And longer than when we were evaluating what to do in commodities and where the advantage and edge was back in the 90s, is the pits, you know, in terms of minute to minute and flow had an advantage. And within a day, a Goldman Sachs, Aaron, or Morgan Stanley, whatever, had the advantage. Yeah. And yet where we had the advantage was duration. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I've seen times where the financial flows both broke the liquidity and changed the S&D of markets.
Yeah.
So we've seen it this year in some of the softs, and then some we saw it in copper as well this year. But the real example is, it's, you know, I saw it in 06 when the commodities as an asset class, you know, you had copper, which was in the physical surplus, okay? But, and then so the curves always are driven by the S&D, okay?
Yeah.
So is if you're going to move into a contango, you're in surplus. And so we were in a physical surplus for copper, but the 500,000 tons of demand of futures absorbed that surplus plus the incremental hedging. And so even though the market went from backwardation to contango, we still rose massively in price because there was a financial futures deficit in purchasing versus physical. Yeah. And then, oh, wait, you really saw it in terms like, you know, Cargill came to us and asked us to take some inventory off of their balance sheet because they were having problems making the margin calls, even because we, you know, went to, you know, $18 or $20 or whatever in terms of that. And just purely the working capital strain on the physical merchants from the financial price that was driven, you know, created, temporary. And so the aspect of having positions that are small enough for your firm to be able to manage, you know, these move to that duration, and also to be able to manage in the market, you have to be smaller today than you were. The duration liquidity, so prompt liquidity is as high as it's ever been. The duration 1 year and out is less than it ever used to be. And so, and those are a lot of times the price in the time of playing. So you need to have a smaller asset base. You need to have, you know, sort of smaller positions. And so the systems and the advantage that we have versus Anthony is we cross multiple markets. And is if you're focused on just cocoa or cocoa in or coffee, or is you gosh darn better be right on that one thing.
Yeah.
And so, and whatever that, that's a really narrow opportunity set. Okay. And so the systems are creating larger and more frequent breaks and volatility and sort of a fair value. So if a fair value for cocoa, let's use the old prices, $2,000. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, in the old days, they could take it to sort of 1800 or 2200.
Yeah.
Now they'll take it to 1600 or 2400 and they'll do it a lot more. And so you're creating greater amplitude of risk and volatility around the fundamentals and more often. So as a fundamental trader, it's giving me more opportunity sets, but I need to have a smaller position to be able to manage that greater risk, and it's happening across markets. And so that's something that we think in the medium, because fundamentals in the end always matter. Like if I take coffee to $3.35 a pound, it's going to $1.25. Okay. It is, you know, a couple, you know, but the path and the risk and the backwardation management and the timing, you know, is the real critical variable. But what this is doing, the price does, you know, you can't change the inordinate level of supply and demand, you know, for something barring a new structural change in variable. So, you know, if we're moving away from lead acid batteries, there might be a structural change in lead demand, but that's, you're part of the fundamentals. Okay. If you need to keep an industry alive, you know, then that S&D and the duration, which supply and demand are elastic, in the end will swamp that. But holy cow, the 1, 3, 6, 12 month variations around that when supply and demand might be inelastic, okay, is what's really tough to manage. And so it's made it more stressful, more risky along the way. And like I said, is there is a set arb on moving copper from the LME to COMEX, okay? Which got blown up because the funds only buying COMEX copper blew up the merchants and their balance sheet and working capital to where an ARB just completely went beyond that. Now, Milton Friedman looked back at like the Tel-Gazel shaft and long-term capital and said they were right. They're not right if you can't make it to when it comes back in.
Yeah.
You know, the Tel-Gazel shaft was too hedged and they were going to get taken advantage of when they were too big front until they were out. Long-term capital was too big. And so it's again, that aspect of, you know, we've spent a lot of time and investment in trying to understand how the systems operate, how they're positioned, their structures have to guesstimate, try and calculate what they can do and where. We still get it wrong, over underestimate, but we've put a huge amount of time in understanding the dominant force currently in our market and what drives them and their prices. They still don't generate alpha in duration investing in terms of those systems. They, you know, are, you know, generate alpha in the shorter term. Mm-hmm. And so trying to adjust and learn and create, you know, quantitative systems around it to evaluate what they're doing and how it can affect our risk-taking, we've put in, and we're still learning.
And you have you hired different people for that? So really people which you would call quants, and who are able to do that work for you?
We've hired definitely people who, whereas in 2002, I would only need a cocoa analyst, and a copper. Now I also have a cocoa analyst, a copper, and somebody who is quantitative, to assess that aspect.
What is your vision on this world of commodities we're in? What do you have a vision on that? Is that, you know, where you see it going? Because it get more volatile. It was cocoa. It was sugar went through €1,000 here. We had the dairy butter that went through the roof, now all-time high. Cocoa, of course, we had coffee. We have a problem. I mean, what is your vision on the world of commodities? That side.
So the concern I have is, one is the extremes that you can take the price move, obviously, are up into the long side. And so we used to be equally as comfortable being long and short and equivalent in terms of that. We're evolving to where our short positions are always going to be smaller just because you've created a greater tail risk than we ever thought possible and used to. And the other thing that really worries us is the damage you do to liquidity in a market, and then is once those explosions occur. So when nickel, both times, the first explosion, 16 years ago, and then most recent couple of years ago, go to 50, 75, and although the trades were broken, 100,000, okay? You don't ever get that liquidity back either in the outright and the options, and your prime broker and your counterparties are willing to. So the size of capital we can run and the size of positions that we can run, on a go-forward basis is a concern, for us. And look, I do have the underlying paranoia fear in terms of when is the duration when AI can, both take advantage of the short-term data signals and the long-term fundamentals. And, they have the advantage of not sleeping, not taking holidays, not having any emotion or something, you can go through the list. And so at the moment, you're still in a world where quantitative and data and AI and human together are better than either one standalone. So, is AI and related and quantitative aren't as good as that plus a human. But, look, the question for me is the constant evolution and what is the speed of evolution and productivity in terms of systems to remove the human. And we're not set up in terms of size or capital or investment to where we would win when that becomes low. Now, I take a look at the dollars that Citadel is putting in for that, or later, or a Two Sigma. Yeah. Usually not as much in commodities yet, but those are the people I'm 57, is thankful that, probably my competitive edge is another decade. and hopefully, yeah. I'm serious. Is that aspect of a real concern? And do we have to merge or integrate or just really commit to a massively level of different investment to get there is something we're evaluating and is a fear.
There was also something very interesting that I was not aware of, that you also are in, you started a venture firm in Osprey, and it's called, let me see what it is called. Well, you know what it's called. It's
Osprey Egg Science.
Yeah, Egg Science, apologies. Can you tell us something about that, why you started that?
Sure, I'd be happy to. We've always been heavily invested since in 2002, we began acquiring farms in Argentina post the devaluation, which we contributed in with some capital to co-found, along with Soros and others, Adecco Agro, which became one of the larger farming companies. We led and were the controlling for the acquisition of ConAgra's grain and elevated and other terminals, which became Gavilon and became the second biggest mover of grains and oilseeds in the U.S. after ADM, bigger than Cargill. We were the seed capital and incubator for Tays River, which is one of the bigger farming companies in the United States now, and so on. So heavily involved in not just the research and analysis of production ag for commodities, but then also the production. My partner and co-founder, Jason Moraz, in terms of how the firm evolved, and he said we should take advantage of the network and the knowledge that we have in farming, okay, and try and say, okay, with all of the primary sources of what is the need and what works, is can we find technologies that make farming more efficient, more environmentally friendly for the farmer and the world, okay, and have a higher alpha for that? And so it's agricultural technology in terms of venture growth, but only in farming. So not farm to table, not downstream, not lab grown meat, just how do you make farmers more efficient, just as efficient, more and more environmentally friendly indoors and outdoors? And so Jason's the one who really led that and put that together and used our network of primary truth testing of saying, hey, what is the need to our farming and farming partners? And does this solution make sense? And so it was built up primarily with partners' capital and driven by himself.
A nice bridge. And when I saw that, I immediately thought, hey, this is a really great combination between what Dwight is doing now, his passion for cocoa, and what's happening with the cocoa market. So is there anything in the firms that you have invested in where you felt like, hey, this could help the whole yield situation of cocoa that has been a disaster for, for so many years, and, is partly causing the crisis that the industry is in? Is there something where you see, okay, there are opportunities?
So within our network of companies, no. And that's part of the reason why there have been problems with cocoa. It's too small a market and was too unprofitable. Okay? So the primary focus of most agricultural input technology investment is on row crops. Hundreds and hundreds of millions of acres, and trillions of dollars of land of value asset there. Yeah. cocoa is such a small subset and so narrow and so focused. And one of the largest problems has been government intervention interference with the market price getting actually to the farmers and related. So for cocoa specifically, no. Mm. There's aspects of things in terms of permanent crops, like in the nuts, in terms of almonds and pistachios, that there's solutions for that. And something that's tied to a canker, tied to orange trees and related. But in our whole network of companies, nothing that helps with swollen shoot or black powder, you name it. And so, again, that's why it got to the extreme that it did.
Are you, go ahead, Alex.
No, I'm just want to be conscious of time and looking at where we stand. That, we can go on for more hours, I think, but that's not what everybody wants to do now. And also a podcast has to be sort of short so that people can listen to it and not the whole day. I would love to ask one more question. Is there an advice that you give, as such a legend to other people that want to join this commodity industry or maybe already there? Is there an advice that you would give from your side?
So the aspect, some of them that we touched on, being in an environment that supports your learning across a breadth of an aspect that really allows you to grow and develop. And so I had the advantage, again, instead of a range of people and coworkers who were exceptional, to learn from how and what they did, and an environment that also afforded me the resources to go and learn industries. And so that aspect of the opening years of where could you go to learn, and so it's both, but a fundamental and quantitative. Like, you need to be facile with data science and analytics and a way to assess and use that, and with a way to assess the aspect of an industry's fundamentals. It's both skills are needed at this point, and always, the judgment of humans and their involvement in interaction is requisite. The hardest part is most people can learn some aspect of statistics, analysis, programming. And like, you can learn how to assess the balance sheet, both of a industry, supply and demand, and of a company. The aspect of yourself and learning how to manage your issues and being honest with yourself about it, and how to judge other people and their aggregate actions and movement is the part that's hardest for people to learn. Some of it is intuitive and to assess. And so you also then should have some sort of a backup plan. Like, am I just, is there's phenomenal value to just being an analyst and not actually being held to a daily, weekly, monthly P&L and being, honest? Because people always, everyone wants to be a hedge fund manager. Look how much money they make. Okay. Sort of thing. The aspect of probability of success, the duration of that success, the ability to learn and evolve from there and keep it and manage and keep your ego in check. Because probably the number one failure I've seen for phenomenal analysts and traders and hedge fund managers is style drift. Okay. You're a great long short industrial equity manager. Why does that mean you then need to go and trade macro? It's the ability to say no. Mm. And then that discipline is one of the things people don't talk about enough.
Yeah. Thank you very much for your time on this, Dwight. I mean, I really enjoyed it and I learned a lot. And gee, what an amazing experience you have so far. And we will keep following you. And it's amazing. But
what a kind guy. Look, I really enjoyed it, and it is. I don't know what to expect, but I really enjoyed it, and I'm going to recommend this to everyone. Yeah, it was fantastic. Thanks a lot. Well,
I apologize that I struggle and I tend to be long-winded and verbose.
No,
and I acknowledge that fault. I'm not any better at it, but I appreciate you guys' patience.
Yeah, and we will buy you a beer in the summer in Amsterdam.
I look forward to it. And if you guys can help my daughter work on some sort of a better shot or anything such as that, the best compensation possible.
On that good note,
will do.
Thanks a lot and have a great rest of your day.
Thanks, Dwight.
You guys take care.
Thanks a lot, Dwight.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.